Dr. Robert Fenoy, Old Testament History, Lecture Number 6. We were discussing the meaning of the word Yom, end quote, day, which is at the top of page 2 of your class outline. We were still under A, usage of the word. A, I divided into two subheadings, usage in the Old Testament in general, and then usage in the framework of Genesis 1. We had discussed the usage in the Old Testament in general, and we were in the process, as I recall, of discussing the usage in the framework of Genesis 1. Just to quickly reorient ourselves, as I mentioned before, it's my view that there are a number of things in Genesis 1 that point toward understanding Yom as a period of time of creative activity rather than a solar day. Among those things I mentioned, the word is used elsewhere, and that sort of a meaning and usage elsewhere permits that kind of a view within Genesis 1. Secondly, it's not until the fourth day that the lights become used for a measure of time. So it's not until the fourth day that you would have solar days. We discussed something of a source of light prior to that in our discussion of that. Thirdly, if you take, quote, day, end quote, in the structure of Genesis 1 as a figurative designation, rather than a period of time, rather than a solar day, it would be appropriate to understand the phrase, quote, evening and morning, end quote, as an expression for the beginning and the ending of that period of time. We discussed that a bit. Then fourthly, I think this is where we stopped. We noticed a number of things which took place on the sixth day. The sixth day, you had the creation of the animals. You had the creation of man. You had him placed in the garden. You had him given the task of tilling the garden. You had the animals brought to him. He was to name all the animals. We get this by combining information from chapter 2 with chapter 1. He was to name all the animals, and in that process he found none that corresponded to himself. He became aware of that difference between himself and the animals of creation. Then the Lord God put a deep sleep on Adam and took the rib from Adam and created woman. And then he gives that exclamation, quote, now at last, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, end quote, and so forth. Now the question is, did all that transpire within the light period of a 24-hour solar day? In my view, all that happened there seems to suggest that we're in a longer period of time than simply a solar day. I think that's where we stopped. In Genesis 2:23, let me see how the NIV words that. Quote, the man said, this is now, end quote. I think I mentioned just at the end of the hour that could better be translated, quote, now at length, end quote. The RSV there says, quote, this at last, end quote, finally, quote, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman, end quote. I just want to make one further point under this discussion of the usage of Yom, or, quote, day, end quote, in Genesis chapter 1. The seventh day on which God rested from his creative activity is a day which has lasted for a long period of time. At least this is the way I would view it. And to me, that would parallel the other 6 days as long periods of time. In other words, it seems to me when it says of the seventh day that God rested, he ceased then from his creative activity, and in that sense, that rest has continued from then until the present. So that is also speaking of a long period of time. The fact that the period of rest continues does not fit that he ceased for just a 24-hour solar day. He ceased from his creative activity, and he rested. He continues to do that with respect to his creative activity. So the conclusion that I would draw from the text of Genesis 1 itself is that there are factors in Genesis 1 that suggest that the word, quote, day, end quote, or yom, is to be understood as a period of time of God's creative activity, which is of indeterminate length. I don't think there is any way from the chapter you can tell how long or short those periods are. I don't think that sort of information is given, but it does suggest that it's a period of indeterminate length. I think the Hebrew for this passage does relate to it, and undoubtedly that is related to my conclusion there. But you read in chapter 2, verse 2, quote, "The seventh day God had finished the work he had been doing," end quote. So on the seventh day he rested from all his work, quote, "And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done." So we're told that he rested from all the work of creating that he had done on the seventh day. You can just reflect on that text and what that means. Does that mean that in a period of seven successive 24-hour solar days, somewhere way back in the beginning, that God rested from creative work? Was it just for 24 hours, then he resumed it? It seems to me that what it's saying is that after the 6 days of creative activity, he ceased creating and he rested. Now, of course, you can get into all kinds of implications theologically from that. You can get into the question of creationism versus traditionism with respect to men's souls. How is it that life is transmitted from generation to generation? Is there a special creative act involved, or is it something that is passed on from the parents? Now, a lot of those questions are complex, and which we get easily a lot of secular theology. I don't know. I wouldn't push this last point. The counterpoint of it is, and we'll get to that shortly, those that would argue for a 24-hour solar day would also use the analogy of the seventh day to support their case by appealing to Exodus chapter 20, the analogy of 6 days you work, one you rest. That's obviously solar days. We work 6 days, we rest one. And if God did that, we are to imitate him in that, and therefore he must have rested for a solar day. Now my response to that would be, the analogy is in the 6 and 1 sequence, not necessarily in the solar day framework. Student question asked. Vinoy's response. Admittedly, I think it's an indicator that supports generally this idea that the word yom in Genesis 1 does not mean a 24-hour solar day. I don't think you can prove it. I think we're in this whole discussion in an area where there has to be an allowance of difference of opinions and conclusions. I don't think either side can say, it must be, here's what is the constraint of the text. You have to come to this conclusion. By just giving the reasons that have led me to the conclusion which I have had. Let's go on to B. We're not done with this discussion. B is, quote, "main types of views of the days of Genesis 1, end quote. Now, if you glance at your outline, I want to mention this now so we don't get lost in the discussion. There are two subpoints under that. One is, quote, "actual days," end quote. And two is, quote, "non-actual days," end quote. Now, that terminology might be confusing. I'm not talking about solar days versus period of time when I talk about, quote, "actual days," end quote, and, quote, "non-actual days," end quote. If you glance again at your outline sheet, you'll see that under, quote, "actual days," end quote, there's 24-hour solar day view, and there's a period of time of indeterminate length view. They are both actual days, as distinct from a non-actual day view. Now, what I mean by a non-actual day view, we'll discuss in a minute. First, let's look at the actual day view with those two subpoints. Let me say this also before discussing this a bit further. We shouldn't lose perspective on the importance of this discussion of period of time versus 24-hour solar day. That's not, by any means, the most important piece of information in Genesis chapter 1. The general teaching we looked at earlier about God, about man, about the universe, I think that is what's important in Genesis 1 and 2. Whether the day was long in the sense of indeterminate length of time or whether it was short is really not the big issue. Don't lose sight of that, or you're going to get all wrapped up in a discussion of this and push its importance way out of perspective. But let's go back to this then, actual days. First, a 24-hour solar day view. There are really three approaches to this. Let me briefly mention them. One would be seven successive 24-hour days. A second would be what we touched on earlier and discussed in Genesis 1, the restitution of the gap theory, which is based on the verb, quote, become, end quote, of Genesis 1:2, where the earth became void and darkness was over the face of the earth, interprets that the 6 days of creation are not really the original creation, but a reconstitution. You had the initial creation in, quote, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth became void, end quote. Then you have 6 days of reconstitution, you might say, and all the geologic records, fossils included, by those of this viewpoint, are placed in the time prior to Genesis 1:2. Then you get a reordering, a restructuring in the 6 days of the chapter. But many who hold that theory hold to the 6 24-hour day understanding of the days of Genesis 1. The third approach, which would be what is called an interperiod theory. The big idea there were long periods of time between the days of Genesis 1, so that would allow for geologic records to be placed in the framework of Genesis chapter 1. But the days that are spoken of would be 24-hour solar days, interspersed with long periods of time. This third view, interperiod view, Dr. Newman holds a variation of, you might say, in his book, Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, I think it is. It is a very useful book. You might look at it at some point. I believe that's in your bibliography. Maybe not under this point, but page 6, next to the last entry on the page, there's an entry there I should have mentioned, which I didn't. R.J. Snow, quote, how long is the sixth day, end quote. Appendix 3 in Eckelman's book, quote, Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth. InterVarsity Press, 1977. That article by R.J. Snow is an interesting and useful article about that sixth day that we just mentioned a few minutes ago. That's Dr. Newman's book. He suggests that the days are 24 hours each, and that each one opens a new creative period of a 24-hour day, so that he doesn't view the day as a long period of time, but as introducing a long period of creative activity. Some form of interperiod theory, but which would hold a 24-hour day. I guess my difference with that would be, I don't see any necessity, myself, to conclude that there must be 24-hour days in the structure of the days of the chapter, and particularly because of that day 4, that the sun and moon were not placed in position for measurement of days until the 4th day. So what was day 1, 2, and 3? Obviously not a solar day as we see it. That's the crux of the matter in my view. But as I said before, I don't think this is something that we should get so tangled up in and involved in debate that we elevate it way out of proportion as far as its importance. I think the text allows for certain freedom in conclusion because of the lack of specificity. All right, 24-hour day view is what we're discussing. I gave 3 possible alternative conceptions of how that 24-hour day works in the context of Genesis. Chapter 1. Arguments in favor of the 24-hour solar day view, I think, are the following. First, In its primary meaning, the word yom, or day, means solar day. That's normally the way we understand it, and certainly if you just come to a chapter and read it, that's probably your initial understanding. The gap theory would be number two, where you would have, quote, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth became without form and void," end quote. You have an initial creation, then a cataclysmic change. The 6 days that follow would be six successive 24-hour days in which that chaotic condition is restructured. Geologic time is pushed then into the gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. The third view, geological time, is in the structure of the 6 days, but it's interspersed between these 6 days rather than pushed back prior to the 6 days. That's the difference. The first thing, then, was the primary meaning of yom is solar day. Secondly, the phrase evening and morning strengthens that conclusion. I think that's the most obvious initial understanding. Evening and morning speaks of a solar day. The understanding I was arguing for requires a figurative understanding of that, and I don't think that's such an objection that it ruled out the day-age view, but it does require it, the use of evening and morning. Then, Exodus chapter 20, verses 9 through 11, what I just mentioned a few minutes ago. In Genesis chapter 20, verses 9 through 11, 6 days shall we work, and the seventh we shall rest, because in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth, and the seventh he rested. The argument on the analogy with Exodus 20, verses 9 through 11, is that day should be taken in the same sense in both passages, Genesis 1 and Exodus 20. So those are the arguments in favor of a 24-hour solar day. B on your sheet, under actual days, is the understanding of yom as a period of time of indeterminate length. This is often referred to as the day-age view. We've already discussed it. I've given arguments in its favor, so we won't go back into that at this point. But notice that it is an actual, quote, day, end quote, even though it's a period of indeterminate length. It's still an actual period of time. It's a period of time in which God did certain things, and there's a sequence in the chapter of God's creative work. Now, with the day-age view, often the objection to it has been raised, is it not a view that has been adopted in an attempt to harmonize science and the Bible? Isn't that the reason for it? Isn't that view just something that's been generated or adopted in order to harmonize evolution and the Bible? I wouldn't deny that there's a very strong basis for coming to that conclusion. Let me make two comments in that general area. First, I think we have to avoid hostility to science and the tendency to ignore minimizing the importance of this discovery. The Bible believer should not be an obscurantist. What the Bible believer must do is distinguish between well-established scientific facts on the one hand and various scientific theories that are really unfounded or philosophically biased. You have to make distinctions. There's a lot that's labeled scientific that's really not scientific. But we should not bury our heads in the sand and ignore or be antagonistic toward the findings of scientific research. Scientists have discovered a lot of things about the nature of reality through scientific investigations. A lot of that, scientists have discovered, is quite fallible. We have to be able to distinguish between what is valid and what is not valid. That's one thing. We should avoid hostility to science and use it discriminatively. But secondly, we shouldn't try to force agreement between scientific theories and the Bible by twisting or forcing some of the statements of the Bible to fit certain theories. Be careful of that. I think we should always be on guard against that. But having said that, I think at the same time we can say that sometimes scientific discoveries may give cause to re-examine certain biblical texts to see exactly what they say. Often you will find that the text may not be as specific as you may have initially thought it to be, and it's the scientific investigation and conclusions that become the stimulus or the motivation to look again at the text and look at it perhaps more carefully than you'd look at it initially, and to see in what parameters the text itself allows you to move. I think that's important. I'm sure most of you are familiar with Dr. Francis Schaeffer's Genesis in Space and Time. On page 57 of that volume, he's discussing the days of Genesis 1, and I won't read much of his discussion, but at the conclusion of it, he says, quote, "Therefore, we must leave open the exact length of time indicated by, quote, day, end quote, in Genesis, end quote." In other words, he doesn't come down hard one way or the other, solar day or period of time view. Then he says, quote, "From the study of the word in Hebrew, it is not clear which way it is to be taken. It could be either way, in the light of the word, as used in the Bible, and the lack of finality of science concerning the problem of dating, in a sense, there's no debate, because there are no clearly defined terms upon which to debate," end quote. I think with Schaeffer, the scientific materials have caused him to look again at the text, and then you see the text allows for certain room or freedom there to move in accordance with the scientific data where it may lead you without twisting or distorting the text. So I think those things are important. Avoid hostility to science. Don't try to force statements of the Bible to fit theories, but on the other hand, let the scientific discoveries that do seem well-founded and may well be a stimulus to re-examine the text and see exactly what it says. Number 2, under types of days, years or days of Genesis 1, is non-actual days. What's a non-actual day? I think we'll see by way of illustration. In general, this would be a view that sees no real historical connection between the days of Genesis and the sequence or process of God's creative activity. Now, there are a number of varieties of non-actual day views. The first one, which would be small a, is the view of Origen. Origen was a church father from Alexandria, 185 to 253 AD. He viewed the days of Genesis 1 as symbolic of the order of God's creative activity. He says that the creation came to pass in a moment, and the 6 days are merely indicative of a logical order. Origen says, quote, "No one of good mind can accept that there was actually a first, second, and third day, as well as an evening and morning, without sun, moon, and stars," end quote, leading back into that problem of the fourth day. And he has a point. The creation came to pass in a moment, and the 6 days are merely indicative of a logical order. If you look at page 7 that I just handed out on your bibliography, third entry, Origen on First Principles, Harper and Row, 1966, page 288 is where he makes that statement. So that's one variety of a non-actual day view going way back to the early centuries of the church. Augustine also has a non-actual day view. I think you would call it an allegorical type of view. Understanding exactly what he means by some of his statements about the days of Genesis 1 is not easy. But in Oliver Buswell's Systematic Theology, Volume 1, this is at the top of page 7, the first entry there, pages 142 to 144, he discusses Augustine on the creative days, and he says, Augustine's City of God, Book 11, Section 6 and 7, he says, quote, "What kind of days these are is extremely difficult and perhaps impossible for us to conceive, and how much more to say," end quote. That's quoting Augustine. He goes on to say, quote, "Morning returns when the creature returns to praise and love the Creator. When it does so in the knowledge of itself, that is the first day. When in the knowledge of the firmament, that is the name given to the sky between the waters above and the earth beneath, that is the second day. And when in the knowledge of the earth and the sea and all things that grow out of the earth, that is the third day. And when in the knowledge of the greater and lesser luminaries and all the stars, that is the fourth day," end quote, and so forth. Buswell comments, "It seems that Augustine took the word, quote, day, end quote, in this scripture passage to refer to the spiritual experiences of the creature in returning both to praise and love the Creator, in view of the various aspects of creation," end quote. He comments, quote, "We cannot judge Augustine by our standards and rules of grammatical or historical hermeneutics. He was notoriously allegorical on his exegesis. We can only note that this great father of the church in the 5th century, probably the profoundest theologian since the Apostle Paul, unquestionably loyal to the Bible, interpreted the days of Genesis creation record in what seems to us a rather fanciful manner," end quote. It seems it's an allegorical type of view of the days, their non-actual days, with respect to any historical sequence in God's creative activity. That's the point. It has more to do with the spiritual experience of the believer in responding to God's creative work. A third category under non-actual day would be the revelational day view. This would be C, revelational day view. On your bibliography, down in the middle of the page 7, you see D.J. Weissman, Clues to Creation in Genesis, Part 2, Creation Revealed in 6 Days. D.J. Weissman argued that God revealed creation in 6 days to Moses, so that the days of Genesis 1 are not solar days or age days indicating a time of creation, rather they are solar days indicating a time of revelation. It was creation revealed in 6 days. I find it very difficult to find that in Genesis chapter 1. It seems what's being spoken of is not God's revelation to Moses of what he had done in 6 days of revelational activity, but what he actually did in terms of creative activity. But this view is certainly a non-actual day view, which with respect to the days of creation. Now, see what's behind this? This is relatively recent, 1977. I think, again, is this harmonization of science and the scripture? If you have a certain sequence in God's creative activity, how do you match that up with what scientists are telling us about the sequence and what we can find with respect to creation of different life forms? If you remove sequence from Genesis chapter 1, then you no longer have any problems. The next view I'll mention, which is a non-actual day view, is the view that I would say is most popular among contemporary evangelicals who hold to a non-actual day kind of view. I'll call that the framework hypothesis or double symmetry views. Probably the most influential advocate of this in English writing is N. H. Ritterwoss. That's your fourth entry on page 7 in his little book, quote, "Is There a Conflict Between Genesis 1 and Natural Science?" End quote. Erdmans, 1957. That's a translation from a Dutch book. He later wrote a more extensive volume on the same subject in 1963 that I have listed there in Dutch, but it's never been translated into English. In Ritterwoss's view, the 7 days of Genesis 1 are a literary framework into which the creation narrative is set, thus framework hypothesis. It's a literary framework into which the creation narrative is set. In its view, the days are a literary device and are not to be taken as having chronological significance. It is just a pure and simple literary device. There's no chronological significance. They're non-actual days. They're not days that actually took place. It's a literary framework to tell the story of creation. Ritter-Voss says, quote, "The 6 days of Genesis 1 are obviously intended as the sum of two tridiums, that is, two sets of three, which consequently reveal a clearly pronounced parallelism, while the total arrangement is intended to place in bold relief the surpassing glory of man who attains his true destiny in the Sabbath." Given this plan of the creation account, we may infer, meanwhile, that the author consciously used days and nights, evenings and mornings as a literary framework. The specific order belongs to the writer's method of work, not God's creative acts, end quote. The order belongs to the writer, not the work, not God's creative acts, although it may symbolize the idea that creation is well ordered. Now you see what he did. He drew a parallelism between the first 3 days and the second 3 days. Day one, you have light, whereas in day four, you have the light bearers, the sun, moon, and stars. Day two, you have the firmament and the division of the waters above and below, whereas in the fifth day, you have the fish and the birds. The parallelism is something that's disputed, but you can perhaps see it here, or perhaps you'll find a problem with it. But the third day, you have the dry land separated from the sea and vegetation. And then you have the inhabitants of the earth, animals and man, on the matching sixth day. That leads up to the seventh day of special significance, the Sabbath. You find rest in the Sabbath. Now, let me push that up a bit. You have eight creative acts, four on the first 3 days, four on the second 3 days, which means you have two each on the third and the sixth days. Those creative acts are introduced by the phrase, quote, "and God said," end quote. If you go down through the chapter, you find that phrase, quote, "and God said," end quote, repeated. You see in verse 3, quote, "and God said, let there be light," end quote. We have it once on the first day, then verse 6, quote, "and God said, let there be a firmament," end quote. That's the second day. Verse 9, quote, "and God said," end quote, is on the third day. But verse 11, you see, you have two on the third day, verse 9 and verse 11. Then verse 14, you have, quote, "and God said," end quote. Verse 20, "and God said," end quote. Verse 20 is, quote, "and God said," end quote. That's the fifth day. And then verse 24, quote, "and God said," end quote, and 26, you get two on the sixth day. So you get two each on the third and sixth days, and a total of eight. So with that kind of a schematic structure to the chapter, the conclusion is drawn that what you have here is a literary device to structure the creation account, and that the days are not actually days of God's creative activity. They're a literary device of the writer in presenting God's creative works. Buswell, in Volume 1 of his Systematic Theology, discusses this view. On page 143, here's what he says of it. He mentions Ritter-Voss's book, and then he says, quote, "I must confess that the alleged symmetry between the two groups of 3 days each seems to me like seeing faces in the clouds. Yes, the faces are really there and can be seen by others to whom they are pointed out, but the question is whether they were intended. What one person sees as a face in the clouds, others may see as an animal or a tree, and the same person may see the same cloud formation in two different patterns depending somewhat on what way he directs his vision. I'm not at all convinced that Moses, as inspired by the Holy Spirit, intended any parallelism between days 1 through 4, 2 through 5, and 3 through 6. For one thing, if the days are to be matched, it would seem to me that day 3 matches day 5 better than it matches day 6. End quote. In other words, if you're going to see a parallelism, he sees dry earth separated from sea and vegetation more with fish and birds than with the inhabitants of the earth, animals and man. And the parallelism seems stronger between 5 and 3 than it does with 3 and 6. Then he goes on and he says, quote, "There are other points in which I cannot see that parallelism," end quote. He adds, quote, "Certainly, it's not a heresy for one to see or imagine that he sees such an intended parallelism. What I do object to is the inference that the alleged double parallelism in the 6 days of creation somehow or other erases the theme across the order of events enumerated one after another," end quote. In other words, what he objects to is getting rid of the idea of sequence. But if you take the days of a literary device that has nothing to do with God's creative activity in the 6 days, you have ridded the chapter of sequence in God's creative activity. And, of course, that's Ritterwoss's point. He wants to do that because you notice the title of his book is, quote, "Is There a Conflict Between Genesis 1 and Natural Science?" End quote. And the way he avoids the supposed conflict is by ridding Genesis chapter 1 of any sequence. Now, there you get back to this question. Are you forcing something on the chapter that arises out of scientific data that really doesn't do justice to the chapter? I want to discuss this double symmetry view a little bit further. There's some other objections that seem to me to be important to this view. I would say I think this view is important because increasingly evangelicals seem to be latching on to it. This ends Dr. Robert Vinoy's Old Testament History, Lecture Number 6.